The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Allegra Stratton.
And I'm Tom Clark.
First, it was progressive conservatives. Now, the coalition are talking about progressive cuts and going all progressive on prisons.
So we asked the question, is Labour being progressively defrocked?
Joining us in our peace pod today, we have Guardian's leading columnists and star progressives, Jonathan Friedland and Madeleine Bunting.
Now, psychologists worry a lot about labelling theory, but should political parties do the same? In today's Guardian, Timothy Garton-Ash argues that Liberal Democrats is such a meaningless name that the party needs to get back to calling itself the Liberals so people know it stands for something. There's something of a theme here, because yesterday we had the outgoing MP for Cannock Chase, Tony Wright, arguing that the term progressive, which all parties claim to be, now means nothing at all. Jonathan, do you think political labels mattered, and do we need new ones in this new politics that we've got with the coalition?
The trouble with a new name, I think, is that in politics there is something to be said for history and for legacy and tradition. And if you have a new name, then the trouble is the novelty wears off and you may go out with it. You know, New Labour, which was an attempt in some ways to rename the name, it lasted a good long time, but it caused huge problems. And in the end, the party couldn't move from Labour because it had a whole lot of history and loyalty and sort of affiliation that went with it. What's interesting about Timothy Garton-Ash's argument, in a way, he's dealing with my objection in advance, because he's saying let's go back to the name that actually does have the whole historic inheritance. And there would be something very appealing about that. I can't help just thinking in quite a sort of superficial way that would cause problems, though, for the wing of the party that did join it as Social Democrats. This sort of thing that Timothy Garton-Ash is suggesting becoming Liberals, you could probably do when there's no one around who was ever in the SDP, when all of that generation, Vince Cable and that generation, have sort of died off, Charles Kennedy and the others, and no one remembers that old split, then you could probably do it. But right now there's a, I don't know how many it is, but there's a faction certainly within the Lib Dems who feel they are Democrats first. They were SDP people. It's probably a lot of their grassroots, exactly. So you don't want to lose. So that's the sort of mechanistic problem you'd run into.
But for them in particular, there is a real issue here, isn't there? Because they're desperately scrambling to maintain a distinctive identity in a country that's used to thinking of the government as one thing. They're part of the government, nodding away with David Cameron at Prime Minister's questions yesterday. So it would be a good idea for them to be able to claim that they stand for something very simple that you could sum up in a word.
It would be good, but I think the naming is the least of the problems. The problem is the product. Yep. And the union with the Conservatives is their fundamental problem. It means their distinctiveness, their place in the political marketplace, has been squeezed out, because, you know, if this government does well, then what you're going to do in 2015 is vote Conservative. And if it does badly, you're going to vote for the party that opposed the government. That will be Labour. So this is, I think, the big political problem for the Lib Dems. Much deeper than the problem of their name is what purpose do they have in this quite binary system that really our politics may become even more so.
Madeleine, that's the liberal bit of Liberal Democrat. This week, the Tony Wright article was talking about that progressive, which is sometimes a byword for those on the left, and that the Tories have tried to nick it, and, you know, who owns it is a big argument to have. But there's another book that's come out, which is the Tony Judd book, about European social democrats are just in general having a crisis of identity. Are they onto something? Is that why Labour is struggling at the moment?
I think we've lost any sense, really, as to what progressive means anymore. That, I think, is a real problem for Labour. And it's a two-part problem, really. One is that the language has been nicked by the Tories. And on the other hand, it's kind of collapsed underneath them in that sort of Tony Judd sense, because Blair used the word progressive a lot and applied it to many aspects of his sort of new Labour agenda, which large parts of his party did not actually regard as progressive. So, you know, if one wants to look at the bastardisation of progressive, when did it start? David Marquand pointed out, you know, 3 or 4 years ago that this word was no longer actually really meaning anything. It had no sort of traction.
Why do people use it?
Well, because I think it kind of
sends out... Why are we using it?
Well, exactly. And when you said, you know, Johnny and I are leading progressives, I flinched because
I think
actually...
you both did.
I don't know what it means, and I don't think it's appropriate. Do we care about social justice? Yeah, I think kind of label these things as they are. And if that is the bit of progressive that one's trying to indicate by using the word, let's get back to using social justice, because I think justice is actually much clearer cut. Progressive, you know, frankly, could mean anything. I mean, it can mean kind of kicking masses of people off welfare benefits. So, and, you know, that's precisely the way in which the Tory party are now trying to kind of twist the word, which is that, you know, you're basically saying this is the future and we're going to do it and it's the right future. that progress in that sense, you know, it kind of has lost all meaning.
You'd have to go back probably to Lord Salisbury to find a prime minister who would have said the forces of reaction need to balance the forces of progress. So it's a fairly outmoded view of things to take now. But progressive does mean something specific in one context, of course, which is when it comes to tax, whether people with the broadest shoulders pay the most. And that's one area where the coalition's been put to quite a specific test and failed it, Madeleine.
Well, I think if we could get the word back to that really, really clear and important use of the term progressive or regressive as to how a tax distribution, you know, I think that would be a great kind of cleaning up of the language. But I think you're referencing back to Victorian Britain about reaction and progress is exactly the right kind of paradigm. And, you know, clearly it's absurd. But I think there's the bigger problem than progressive, because actually, you know, this problem has been around for a while. Ever since the Tories started calling themselves the Progressive Conservatives, we all started thinking, well, what the hell does that mean? I think actually it's a problem of social democracy. And, you know, Tony Judd, I think, has really kind of eloquently put a question on the map, which Labour is going to wrestle with. And the thing about Tony Wright's piece yesterday, which I think is really the first time I've seen anyone really kind of laying it out, is that there's a real danger of complacency in the Labour Party, that they can just sort of sit this one out in terms of just picking up easy political fruit. You know, there'll be outrage about various slashing of public spending measures, and Labour can just think, OK, well, we'll roll back into power on that wave of disaffection. And it seems to me that is a fundamental misreading of what's going on and a fundamental misunderstanding of why the public actually did not back Labour at the last election.
Johnny, isn't there a problem here? Because for Labour, they think that they are on the right side of the intellectual argument about the deficit. Tony Wright's article was saying they need to do something almost for positioning. So they need to get over the deficit, and they need to start talking about what cuts they would come up with, when they don't believe that they should come up with cuts because they believe that they should still be fiscally stimulating.
I mean, first of all, on the word progressive, and we all agree that the word has become completely emptied and hollowed of meaning. And a little mischievous voice inside me wants to say, you say that like it's a bad thing. For politicians, that's exactly why they were all using it, because it became so empty. And the equivalent word a bit in the 80s was radical. When people in the Labour argument would say, I'm on the radical wing of the party, it was a way of, it didn't commit you to anything. Thing, but it still meant it sounded as if you had sort of fire in your belly. And progressive is one of those words where its very emptiness is why a lot of politicians like reaching for it, because it doesn't commit you to anything. And when we're on labels, it's only a label where the opposite would have some meaning that is useful. So just as Tom was saying, there's nobody around who would say I'm regressive. So therefore, the word obviously is a bit empty. But on the policy point you're making, I do think Labour think they are on the right side of the argument. They take a lot of heart from the fact that the Obama administration, that gives them huge cover, that the Obama administration is now pitting itself, if you like, against Europe and those parts of the G20 on this big argument. The problem slightly is that it means Labour is invested in failure. Labour need the economy in its crudest form to go into a double dip recession so they can say, see, we warned you. And that's in a way, that's a dangerous place for a political party to be, because you're on the side of pessimism, etc. But I think it does let them off that very important hook where, in a way, they can say, look, we don't have to start getting into exactly what cuts we would have made, because we don't think you need to cut as far and as fast and as deep. And the reason why they're off that hook is actually because of George Osborne's budget. If he had matched pound for pound the £44 billion commitment, I think it was, Labour had for cutting, then it's an argument about where you cut. And Labour would be absolutely on the defensive and in a corner where they'd have to say how much. Once Osborne went way beyond that, well, Labour can get into a completely different game saying, well, we wouldn't do this. And no one can really sort of say, well, which bit was in the bit you would have done, and which bit's in the excessive bit, because actually they can shift the terrain. So Osborne has left himself open to that, I think.
But Madeleine, although that potentially leaves Labour in a good position to oppose the cuts, I think I picked up from what you were saying that you sensed that there was a broader problem here of being defined by nothing more than just defending services as they are at the moment, and defending in particular the state.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think that, you know, Johnny's point about the kind of pessimism that Labour is in danger of getting wrapped up with, and a sort of very kind of status quo, defence of the status quo, I think these are two really big dangers for Labour, because then everybody feels, oh, well, we know what they're going to say. They become predictable. They're offering no alternative, no future. And, you know, this is the kind of doldrums that I think any party falls into after a long period in power. It's partly about a kind of political exhaustion. It's partly about a preoccupation, which I think is really evident in the race, with protecting and defending the record. That is an understandable concern for a generation who've all been in the cabinet. You know, they're concerned to keep the record straight. And of course, the record is getting attacked by the coalition. But, you know, that is not a great form of politics to kind of pull yourself out of. You know, defending your record is not actually what the British electorate want to hear. You know, they
so
heard...
what would be? What
to
would
the
be...
extent that they're listening at all.
Well, exactly. I mean, I think that there's no shortcut here. There's no easy way back for Labour. So you've got to kind of really play a long game. And it's about really kind of rethinking what exactly is kind of Labour's offer. And I think that involves some really serious examination of where social democracy has kind of has failed. Obviously, there are places where Labour has done great successes. So I'm not in here for kind of bashing Labour, but I think there's got to be an honest appraisal about where social democracy failed, because that's where the electorate lost faith. They lost the sense of legitimacy about high public spending in areas, for example, of welfare. I mean, somebody pointed out to me that in an area of Kent, where you've got two boroughs, they both have such high levels of chronic unemployment that between them, they're swallowing up hundreds of millions of pounds every year from the taxpayer. And, you know, that is pretty much absolutely run all the way through New Labour. There was no Labour policy that really worked out. Mm. How are you going to turn around those areas of chronic deprivation, poverty, low aspiration, intergenerational unemployment, high levels of incapacity benefit? And those are all the areas where Tories are really trying to...
So do you think that IDS was onto something with the geographical on your bike stuff? With those areas of Kent.
No, I don't like that policy. I don't think the Tories have got the answers here. That's why I'm so keen Labour should really start thinking in a completely creative way, to start thinking in a more creative way than they've had the ability or the opportunity or the space to do for 15 years. You know,
you were writing this week, Madeleine, about people who provide public services maybe going in to live with people who use them. I mean, is it that type of thing where you're really asking people not just to do something managerial, but to go and spend a day in another man's shoes, in the old phrase?
Well, you know, I think that was a really kind of fascinating example of the kind of way we have to really rethink public services. Because what happened with, you know, under Labour was that they added kind of this massive managerial apparatus to the state. You know, Labour has always regarded the state as the central agency for bringing about transformation. So, you know, that was already there. It's always in its history. It's the Webb history. It's the kind of welfare, post-war, Second World War welfare state. But it has created such an enormous gap between those who deliver the services and those who use them. And the result is chronic failure. It's not for lack of goodwill. A lot of the people that are trying to deliver these services are immensely highly motivated and very hardworking. But I think what was so interesting, and, you know, there's plenty of people that have been trying to get this through to Labour over the last 10 years. Participle, run by Hilary Cottam, has been kind of thinking, you know, how do you actually really understand what can turn things around? And it's often the people themselves that are using the services that have got the best ideas.
The first point is that it isn't actually always Labour's history to be wedded to the state. There was a whole early history when it was the party of mutualism and friendly societies and trade unions, etc. Mm. And I think there'll be a lot of people trying to recover some of that history. But now, maybe just this, and not now the next 5 years, but the next year may not be the time to do this. And that for a couple of reasons. The first is because actually this is going to be a pretty good year for the state in terms of public opinion, I think, which is as soon as people see cherished public services removed locally, so the local library closing, etc., suddenly people are going to think this thing that has been demonised in public rhetoric for so many years, the central state or government or public sector, actually is pretty valuable. If you start cutting it by 25%, a lot of people are going to suddenly feel the need and realise, well, there's quite a lot that they like and cherish about the public sector. That plus the fact that the Labour's argument, which I think is sound, is you don't have to do this deficit cutting when your economy is still so fragile. After that year, what would be bad, and here's where I absolutely agree with Madeleine, would be if they slide into this comfort zone of just defending the status quo. I think that's a very bad place for a progressive party, radical party, an opposition party to be. They can't be in that as the defenders of the status quo. So right now, I don't think can happen, because people right now are going to be thinking about the public services they like. After that, Labour absolutely does have to get into the territory Madeleine was staking out there, which is rethinking a bit. And there, I think there is huge opportunity, because what Labour can do, and here's an open goal has been created by Osborne, the government is unbelievably crude about this business. If they are really serious about cutting government departments by a quarter or a third, what needs to happen is this really intelligent, nuanced, calibrated rethink, where some departments may actually need much more money to do what they're doing, and others may need budget cuts of 75%. This across-the-board sort of butchery is very, very crude. And what you could have is a whole intelligent, thought-through Labour approach, which says some government services have way outlived their usefulness. Others, we need more of them and more resources, and make it very nuanced and subtle. And for that, you do need the kind of deep thinking that Madeleine was talking about.
I think Johnny's got a good point about the timing, but it seems to me that there are different tasks for different people. So what needs to happen amongst the thinkers in, you know, the Labour Party or associated with the Labour Party? I mean, that's what they're doing anyway. They are thinking, and they've got to think really hard, and there's got to be some really kind of creative work done now, so that in maybe a year, 18 months, 2 years, the ideas look quite credible for whoever's running the Labour Party to start engaging with them. It's not that, you know, you can't expect the kind of current crop of sort of leadership candidates to start broaching this kind of debate. It's much too complicated. And interestingly, I was very impressed by somebody who said, you know, this is not going to be easy, because Blair defined New Labour as breaking and disrupting the Labour tradition. Now, the whole point about a tradition is that you can go back into it, dig out the bits that have been there that are useful. As Johnny says, there's a very, very interesting Labour tradition of mutualism. And it wasn't just preceding the Webs. It was actually parallel to the Webs. So, you know, you get GDH Cole, whose ideas about mutualism are badly in need of resurrecting now, because I think it would give Labour this kind of new vision of how you reinterpret, reimagine the welfare state. And I think it's the thinkers, the backroom boys and girls, if you like, yes, who need to really get their thinking into order so that it's ready for when the leadership have got the political space to start bringing these ideas into the public domain.
Just a little word of defence, though. I mean, they were doing some of this stuff before the election, weren't they?
They absolutely were. And people like James Purnell and others were really trying to do...
inside government as well.
And yes, I mean, but he was doing it when he was in government, yeah, and there's other people who carried on. They were doing that. It's a very, very hard thing to do in opposition, because the clarity of your message now must be, here's the government, the coalition government, slashing and burning, and they shouldn't be. And it's very hard to sort of nuance that with saying, but nevertheless, you know, even though we're defending the state, we do need to have a different kind of reduction in some areas and a rethinking. So it's a more nuanced message, but absolutely they're equipped to do it, I think.
Well, one thing I think we have agreed on is to ditch the word progressive. So let's not use that for a minute. But when the old Tory warhorse Ken Clark charged into battle on prisons yesterday, no one could doubt, I think, that he sounded a damn sight more, let's call it, forward-looking than the likes of David Blunkett and Jack Straw. Here is the Justice Secretary in full swing.
What's the balance between the assertion of rights and the responsibility to accept the burden of using your own resources to assert them? And it may be that people have to sometimes pay more of their own legal costs than has been the case in some areas of law in the recent past.
He went on to say that prison numbers have doubled since the time when, back in the 90s, he was last in charge of them. And he also proposed freeing judges to get sentences right instead of Parliament passing more minimum terms. Johnny, it was like listening to a Guardian editorial being read out, wasn't it?
It was a very pleasing feeling, wasn't it? No, we did all like that. But Ken Clark is one of those sort of licensed heretics. You know, he is an exceptional figure. He has so much clout and, in a way, is you know, impossible to sort of tame. And therefore, he may not be typical of a drift of the whole government. This is him. That, on the other hand, but related, is that it's easier, in a way, for a Conservative to say these things than it was for a Labour politician. This is the classic Nixon to China principle, that, you know, it's somebody of the right who can make the apparently progressive or liberal gesture. It's much easier. Straw and Blunkett had that weight of Labour history, to go back to that, on their shoulders all the time, where they felt Labour had always been bashed for being soft on crime, so they felt they had to show how hard they were. And Clark walks in with this huge Conservative history of being, in some cases, lunatically tough on law and order, so he can move in the other direction. So he's got that huge space open for him. I don't think it's any... People have been writing this up as connected with the coalition, that it's there because the Lib Dems are there. I don't think it is that. I think it's what Clark can do, A, because he is in some ways a maverick, and B, because he's a Conservative and a former Home Secretary at that. So he's actually got that space to make a move that I think all the evidence and the policy experts would all tell you is into the sensible space.
There is a Tory tradition here, isn't there, Madeleine, on penal reform? You know, Willie Whitelaw was always a Liberal voice, and Douglas Hurd, Home Secretary for much of the 80s, went on to be in charge of the Prison Reform Trust. So should we be surprised? Is this not really a left-right issue at all?
You mentioned several Tory Home Secretaries. I mean, the one that is really kind of dominant in my mind is Michael Howard. So, you know, I think it's the way Howard's thinking has kind of dominated.
Howard's way.
Exactly, that's it. And so, you know, this is a real shift in tone. I mean, Anne Widdecombe, when she was Home Office Minister for Prisons, I think would probably be sympathetic to many of the kind of issues that Clark is raising. So there's always been sort of, you know, a variety of voices in the Tory
and
party.
And she clashed with Howard, of course. I mean, famously, in the Home Office.
Famously. But Howard really did, I think, kind of define Tory policy on prisons for in a very kind of clear-cut way. I just would also add, though, that, you know, the clip we just heard from Clark raises a very ominous prospect, which really alarms me, and which is not very progressive at all, if we're still trying to use this bankrupted word. I mean, we're delighted he's kind of raising some interesting and much, much needed debate about prisons. On the other hand, he's talking about reducing legal aid. I mean, if that's I understood the phrasing of that.
Yes.
It was obviously coded, but, you know, the idea that people should use more of their resources to assert their rights. I mean, this is a story that's been pretty sad under Labour. And, you know, the idea that it could get even worse under the Tories is really disturbing, which is that there are significant sections of the population who badly need legal aid, and that, you know, the restrictions on that became tighter and tighter under Labour. This is the fourth pillar of the welfare state that never got funded properly. And, you know, we could really actually see this pillar completely fall over in the next few years.
Although Labour had already penciled in huge cuts to it. And what Clark said in one of his classic Clark lines yesterday was, you know, it costs £38,000 a year to pack these prisoners off to a grossly overcrowded hotel. And within what's going to be a squeezed budget, whoever, I mean, isn't, as a former lawyer, isn't he actually reasonably well placed to contain the cuts to legal aid compared to what a Labour Home Secretary might be?
You know,
if he gets a grip on prisons, then that's the biggest item of spending. And so,
yeah, I mean, I'm not disputing that Labour was cutting legal aid. Mm. But, you know, when you talk to any kind of legal aid centre or Citizens Advice Bureau, and what they will say to you is that, you know, for a significant proportion of the population, they can no longer use the law, you know, whether it's trying to protect them getting evicted from a house or trying to get kind of, you know, welfare rights. I mean, it's not just about criminals needing legal aid. It's about, you know, a whole range of people who are extremely vulnerable by all kinds of measures and who desperately need legal aid. You know, it could be, you know, care proceedings. I mean, talk to people who are trying to kind of hang on to their kids or at least get themselves represented properly through a care proceedings. You know, where's the legal aid? Mm. It can be extremely hard. What people say is, unless you're sort of there in the queue at the Citizens Advice Bureau at 6 o'clock in the morning, you know, you're just not going to see anybody.
Johnny, that's one funding problem. The other funding problem is how he's going to pay for this community rehabilitation.
Well, I suppose he'll be trying to make the argument that if you have fewer people in prison, that frees up some budget. I also did...
Go to George Osborne's cuts and get him on the Star Chamber.
Well, and also, no, I interpreted the legal aid move as a sort of trade-off, that he was trying to sort of say, look, I'll save money here, which I'm with Madeleine on this. I think that's a deeply reactionary thing to do, and it will really hit the most vulnerable, especially in the civil courts, etc. But I thought that's what he was doing. He was trying to offer up to his potential critics on the right. I mean, he's trying to sort of placate the male with one hand by saying, look, legal aid and paying fat cat lawyers, all those populist prejudices, I'm going to move on that, and therefore that gives me some cover for the move on prisons. And I think that's both in terms of policy, but also in cost terms. He'll say, I'll save here so that we can spend there.
It's a feasible mechanism, is it, to pay these companies to rehabilitate offenders?
Oh, well, I wasn't saying that. No, I think we'd want to see a whole lot more of the detail on it. I mean, when we said, oh, this could be straight out of the Guardian editorial, you know, not completely. I mean, the sentiment of being against banging people up is in a reflexive way. And Madeleine said before that Michael Howard dominated Tory policy. The truth is he dominated Tory and Labour policy. I mean, Michael Howard set a standard that Blunkett and Straw didn't feel they could depart from, the prison works model. So, you know, in that sense, we're with him in what he's saying, but in the legal aid, but also in the detail of how you do it. You know, my view has always been this is not a cost-saving mechanism at all. If you want to rehabilitate prisoners, really make sure they do not reoffend, it is an intensely expensive exercise involving education, etc., but worth it, because then you don't have crime and you don't have them back in prison 5 minutes later. But I think he needed to present it as somehow a part of the Osborne cost-cutting era.
To underline what you've said, there was an article by Jack Straw which preempted Ken Clark's speech, which denounced Ken Clark as a hand-wringer, written by Jack Straw in yesterday's Daily Mail. Unbelievable stuff. And I think there's a really big question here, isn't there, for all the Labour leadership candidates about whether they want to show they have moved on beyond Blair and Brown. Did they follow Jack Straw, the real embodiment of the old regime, or do they try and say something a bit new, Johnny? What do you think?
I think that is a fascinating question, and civil liberties has been generally fascinating during this Labour leadership contest for, I think, the reason you're saying, because they're torn. On the one hand, they do want to partly reach out again to the Guardian constituency, who, you know, turned on them and went in many cases to the Lib Dems by saying, we now get it on civil liberties, we were too authoritarian. On the other hand, they think there's an old Labourist position, which is that often their own constituents are telling them that, you know, we like CCTV and we want more of it where we live. And so David Miliband, for example, who, you know, on the one hand, you'd think he was absolutely in keeping with sort of modern Primrose Hill, that's where he lives, you know, London, Labour, Guardian, Easter types, you'd think he'd be there. On the other hand, he's the member for South Shields and like saying, actually, some of this is hand-wringing. And if you're my constituents, you're frightened of crime, and you like ASBOs, and you like CCTV. So I think they're already split, and it will be very interesting, I agree, to see how they play out on Clark.
Thanks to Madeline Bunting and Jonathan Friedland. And don't forget, you can add your voice to our debate at our blog, guardian.co.uk/politicsweekly. This podcast was produced by Ian Chambers. I'm Tom Clark. She's Allegra.
And the pair of us, thank you both for lending us your ears.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.